All right. Excellente. A couple things. We're now 2 days in, you know, full days in. And again, I just simply want to reinstate, it's the reason I'm recording these things on two different phones. All this stuff is going to be available to you. And so, again, I'm just reinstating the challenge that I face, that I enjoy. The delicate dance of not too tight, not too loose, not too much, not too little. A lot of information, you know, bordering on TMI, right? Too much. But, you know, again, in the spirit of, like, yoga, stretching is good for growth, I tend to err a little bit on the excessive side, so to speak, because the people that, you know, just, like, aren't there, take a walk, listen to your body, trust what you feel, go read, go up to the stupa, walk into nature. All this stuff will be available for you later. So you don't have to come in here and just drive yourself nuts trying to keep up with this stuff. Because as you'll start to see, as we start to go deeper, become more subtle, this material is not only intellectually challenging, not only is it doctrinally, you know, when I say doctrinally, what that means, you know, doctrine teaching, not only is it intellectually somewhat difficult because it's, you know, subtle, but even more so, the teachings on emptiness and also the Bardo teachings, there's a part of you, really, that does not want to hear these teachings. I'm not being smart out of here. There's a part of you that just does not want to go here. And I remember very, no kidding, very clearly, I don't know if I shared this story, not only with Bardo, but especially with emptiness. And we're slowly working our way towards emptiness. Everything in the Buddhist tradition circumambulates the teachings on emptiness. It's a big deal. And so we're slowly heading towards this vortex, the core of the chipper. And I remember very clearly when I started studying emptiness 30 years ago, I went through a really kind of a bipolar deal for quite some time where part of me, like the manic part of me, I could not get enough. It was like, give me every class, give me every book, you know, what a surprise, I read everything. It was like, give me more. I had no idea what it was, but I just knew there was something here. And I was just manic for the whole thing. And then I would go like depressed about the whole thing. This is BS, this is like ridiculous, it's a total waste of time. And I would kind of ping between these, you know, part of me really wanted to get it, and part of me just wanted to throw up. And so we have to, you know, we have to really play, we have to become our own meditation instructor, our guide. Trust your body, see what feels right for you. If you really feel like, I don't know if I can take any more right now, I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to go take a nap. I'm going to go read my novel. Do it. Do it. You can always have recourse to this stuff later. Be kind to yourself. Maitri, you know the Maitri, beautiful word. Loving kindness towards self. It's kind of important. And so I say that as we, you know, we're 2 days in. We still have another 5 days to go, which is awesome. I can't tell you from my side, it's part of the reason I get so excited and I can't shut up. I've been wanting to present Bardo teaching at this level for like 20 years. And so this is the first time I've had like a full 7 days to just like effing go for it. And so if I get a little excited and a little speedy and a little manic, it's because I've had this pent-up energy for a very long time. And like, you know, the fire hydrant opens up and I'm sorry, I just can't imagine, like, I've got to do it. And so I ask for your forgiveness about just that passion I have for this stuff. But the idea is, very grateful that you're here. Not easy intellectually, not easily emotionally. Not easily emotionally. We are actually going to be talking, and we're going to ramp things up a little bit. I mean, that's just part of the deal. We're going to be, you know, addressing, and we already are addressing, some of the most challenging and tractable topics in all of the human condition. I mean, these are among the most unwanted, difficult things, period. And so we have to be kind to ourselves and be really appreciative of what we're doing, you know, celebrate our courage, and at the same time listen to the inner teacher, okay? So if you need to take a break, do it. So we're only going to go, I love these questions, for the purposes of just keeping things a little bit more spacious, let's plan on going to like 8:30. And if you find at any point, you are not going to offend me. I've been teaching a long time. I got pretty thick skin. If you want to just get up and go for a walk, or go out there and smoke a joint, come back in. That's cool with me. Just bring it in with you. Isn't it amazing? I still can't get over it. You can smoke pot in the state. It still blows me away. And psilocybin is decriminalized. I mean, that's like unbelievable. It's just unbelievable to me. So I'm going to start with some of these questions. And then if you want, we can ping it open, just ask some other questions. Just again, gosh, I mean, what, 7 hours of teaching already? Good Lord, that's a lot. You know, practice in there, but it's a lot. So we'll go till 8:30. If there are some gung-ho people that want to go for a few minutes longer, that's fine. But I want to create a little sense of acknowledgement of the intensity, the volume. We only have a week together. And so, like, you know, do we practice a ton more and hear less? Some people would say, yes, we need to practice more. Other would people say, no, we need to hear more. And so, you know, I got to find the sweet spot. Impossible. Impossible. I'm doing my best. Okay? And I'm acknowledging it from the outside because I've been on the other side. I know how it works. So, enough said. This afternoon you said we were co-creators of our world. Who or what is our co-creator? Oh, very nicely said. Other sentient beings. Other sentient beings. So this is who asked this question? I'd love to know. This is a good question. Yeah, Ted. You going to give us a talk sometime this week, Ted? So bad. So who or what is the co-creator? So it's very interesting. When we dream, we create the dream reality. It's literally called solipsism. Solipsism is the philosophy where, you know, mind is everything. You create your reality. It's a common New Age kind of mistake, fundamentally. But at the level of dream, for the most part, and even there, not entirely, but for the most part in a dream, there's fundamentally no real co-creator. We create that reality, mostly, not always. In this collective dream, a little bit more complicated. This is co-created by other sentient beings with the same kind of karma. And so, Ted, if you really want to read this, I'm going to, again, ping you to resources. The way to dive into this in one of the most profound texts I've read in the last 15 years by Alan Wallace's wife. Have you read this, Dale?
Mm-hmm.
Vesna Wallace. She's one of the world's elite scholars on the Kala Chakra Tantra. Speaks Sanskrit. She learned Mongolian so she could translate from the Mongolian version of the Kala Chakra. And she's translated a number of, there are five chapters on the Kala Chakra Tantra. Those of you who are Shambhalians, the Kala Chakra Tantra is the Shambhala Tantra. So it's incumbent upon deep students of Shambhala to study the Kala Chakra. In the second chapter on the individual, which she translated, which unfortunately it's not cheap. I mean, if you're lucky to get it, it's at least $100. But in this book, she talks, is it, with translation and commentary, with the most elegance I've ever come across, how it is that the universe is created by the karma of sentient beings so that sentient beings can experience the result of their karma together. So we co-collectively as a human species, if you believe in this kind of collective, you can't even say solipsisms, this collective co-creation, that we have enough collective karma of these 27 different domains of samsaric existence to actually have co-created this world system. And so the co-creators are everybody in this room. So this is why you, on one level, when you say, you know, mind creates reality, you create reality, well, you don't create this reality. You don't have that kind of power. That's truly is the era of solipsism. But you do co-create it. We create it in the sense that we color it in our version of what we think reality should be. In exactly the same way, like this little thought experiment we did last night, remember? Mm-hmm. For those of you who may not have been here, you missed it. It was killer-ass cool. What we did was, if you weren't here, it took about half an hour, but it was awesome. Everybody ran out with a flashlight. Remember, this is so cool, wasn't it? It was awesome. Everybody came back. Everybody brought an animal in. And we all sat here. It took a half an hour to guess because some of these were kind of squirrely, literally. We all came in. Then we all held the head of our animal. And that was kind of tough, right? Especially the moose. Who had the moose? We even had the moose. Man, that was tough. Antlers, that's why the doors dinged up back there. And so then what we did is we asked the animals, every animal, it took a while, we asked them to describe what they're seeing here. Well, you know, the bat perceived an ultraviolet. Glass, right? The bee perceived, infrared. Ultrasound. The bee perceived ultraviolet reality. The snake perceived an infrared reality. The snail, which figurates perception something like once every couple seconds, talk about big gaps in perception. It took the snail a little while to get his words out because it took 4 seconds for even 1 second. So where's the real glass? Where's the reality of that glass? You know, there is some matrix. That matrix is co-created. But the actual registration of that reality is created in that sense individually. See? So the rat, whatever, they create their version of this. And so by understanding this, not only with interspecies, but also, I mean, most importantly, practically, at the level of development, this is a profound way to look at things like culture wars and political divisiveness and all these ways that people live, fight, die, kill for their views of reality, all thinking that that's the way things really are. No, it's the way you make it to be. And so by understanding this pluralistic view, what's called relativism, understanding the relativistic nature of the world is extremely important. It's not just a hypothetical thing. It brings tremendous compassion, empathy, and understanding for others who don't share your worldview. And how are you going to communicate with others if you can't tune into their worldview? That's where wars are started. You communicate with people when you love them, when you approach them with compassion, most of the time. There's sometimes when you can't. There's a place for wrathful action. But the idea here is we co-create this reality. Every being in this room helps manifest this together. Every sentient being, animal life, manifests together. But we do not perceive the same reality. We perceive the same infrastructure, the same collective unconsciousness, deeper than the Jungian sense. From the alia, from the eighth consciousness. So again, we keep pinging back to these eight consciousnesses. This collective version comes from the collective eighth consciousness, which is pre-human. It's not even human. So that's where this world comes from. And we are the co-creators of that. See? Okay? Yeah.
This afternoon I understood when you said we co-create the world. I thought if I was looking at that deer outside, that I was co-creating with the deer. If I'm looking at the shrine is the co-creator with me, in the forms you see are the co-creators with you, of what, I thought that's what you meant, and when you just did this animal experiment, each animal co-created something different with the glass.
But the grass is, the grass. The glass isn't sentient, right? The glass doesn't have that creative capacity.
But it does. It's empty, and it's a million atoms moving around.
Exactly. And even then, this is where it gets even more complex. Really.
It could be a teacher.
Huh?
It could be a teacher.
Well, on one level, it is a teacher. But it gets even more complex because depending on where you are individually, like I was alluding to earlier, you will, not only just the other animals, but you yourself will perceive whatever it is, this thing we call glass. You yourself will perceive that differently, depending on your spiritual and psychological status of development. So, in other words, as like I mentioned earlier, when you start to wake up and the lens of perception is purified, not a metaphor, you literally start to see the world differently. There's that same matrix of appearance is there, but you see it fundamentally very different. And just to show you how deep this goes, and I won't elaborate on this. This is Luminous Bardo Dharmata material. So I'm going to ping it out there and you're going to go, oh, and that's fine. Come back next year, we'll talk about this. Fundamentally, all the stuff we're talking about here is still from a relative dualistic point of view. This is still relative perception. At the deepest levels of what's this, these teachings, by the way, are sometimes called teachings on epistemology, right? Ways of knowing. At the deepest levels, and I'm just going to ping it out there and not elaborate on it, at the deepest levels, you don't even perceive the glass. The glass perceives itself. Isn't that helpful?
There's a gas. An audio gas.
I'm going to let that go. This is what we talk about in the Luminous Bardo Dharmata. This type of what's called tantric epistemology, non-dualistic ways of knowing. So these are these topics on perception, cognition, knowing, epistemology. I mean, these are the central teachings of philosophy, mysticism, spirituality, psychology. And so, you know, I'm trying to ping an answer out here in, what, 15 seconds? Not easy.
Can I bring you back to the book that Wallace's wife wrote? What's the
book? Oh, yes, Vesna Wallace, V-E-S-N-A.
Okay.
W-A-L-L-A-C-E. I mean, what a couple they are. You know, B. Allen Wallace and Vesna Wallace. Holy moly. She's an incredible human being. The book is called The Inner Kala Chakra Tantra. That's the title of it. The Inner Kala Chakra Tantra. On the individual. There are five chapters in the Kala Chakra Tantra. The second one is on the individual. And it is stunningly profound. Not easy to read. Like read a paragraph and think about it for a week type of thing. But it's a, has anybody here read this book? Have you read it, Sri? Kind of amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Kind of stunning. Yeah. Yeah, it's beyond profound. And so, you know, again, Ted, if you really want to explore this, Kala Chakra Tantra is where you want to go, second chapter. Somebody else have a comment or question? We're good? Okay. In a lucid dream some time ago, I thought I would meditate, but kind of struggled because I didn't have a breath per se to focus on. Very interesting comment. Could you utilize the formless shamatha while in a lucid dream as a part of dream yoga? Ka-ching! Who asked this question? Emaho, Luke. Absolutely. So, emaho means wondrous, marvelous. You know, like the Sanskrit version of hee-ha. Yes, so in the higher stages of dream yoga, that is in fact what you do. You rest on top of awareness itself. In other words, you allow the mind to just rest on the display of the mind, which in this case is the dream, without becoming attached and seduced into that, right? It's sometimes what's called a witnessing lucid dream, where it, as opposed to the first seven or eight stages of dream yoga, you simply dispassionately witness, you're fully awake in the dream, but instead of engaging it, transforming it, doing all these other practices, you simply bear dispassionate witness to the contents of the dream without getting sucked into it. And that's actually the practice. Because very often what happens is we tend to get sucked into it. Because again, consciousness is a motion detector. Consciousness, the tendency is for mind to get sucked into movement, right? And so the practice there, Luke, is that, you know, you watch the dream, you'll find yourself getting sucked into it. The minute that happens, that's you'll see the transformation from lucidity to non-lucidity. You'll actually find yourself getting lost in the display, in the content of the dream, see? And so when that happens, you'll be able to feel it. It's like, oh, too involved, back up. If you back up too far, what happens? You wake up. So you it's a very beautiful practice where you learn how to walk this tightrope between not too tight, not too loose. If you're too loose, you fall back into the dream, it goes non-lucid. If you're too tight, you're too objective, you pop back out, you wake up. And so the practice then is to watch in this kind of intermediate liminal space. Yeah? Good for you, man. Does a rock have an ego? No. Because egos are basically what? Again, they're sentient developmental stages. And rocks, provisionally, they're not sentient. They're not sentient beings. They don't. And again, it depends on the school. As a sidebar, there's what's called panpsychism, which is the idea that fundamentally even atoms have a type of prehension. Even atoms have a type of pre-consciousness. But even then, rocks do not display developmental stages, at least as far as I'm aware.
Unless they are bodhisattva.
Well put, a child of noble family. Yeah, but then that wouldn't be an ego, right? You would be a bodhisattva. Touché.
Also a different time scale. Billions of years.
But fundamentally, Steve, relatively, rocks do not have an ego because they're insentient. And egos are developmental, basically, kind of stages of perception. So rocks, depending on the view, but classically, generally, rocks don't have that type of perceptive capability. Okay? Oh, another question about egos. This is great. We all walk around with egos, and therefore with triggers. I'm wondering if you could discuss the teachings zoomed in on that trigger. Right in the moment after that blow to the ego. Yesterday we talked about how many times we have to see through the ego before it takes. Tips for seeing through in those most valuable triggered moments. I'm not sure I understand this question. Fire away, Martin.
So, I'm describing those moments where it would be probably the hardest times to actually remember that there are teachings, where something is just... I guess I'm looking to focus on the moments in your life where it would be hardest to remember that there even are teachings. Yeah, like when you're really triggered.
Solid, defensive, contracted, disconnected.
And so, I know all the practices we've learned so far kind of speak to that moment, but I was wondering if you could hone in on things to reach for when we're really in that triggered state.
When we've already lost it, or when we're about to be triggered and lose it?
Both.
Greedy.
I want it all.
Well, okay, let's take the second part first. So when you're about to lose it, one of the things you can do here is this kind of impulse control practice, the pause practice, where with some sensitivity, you will start to be able to become more aware, because you're starting to feel it, right? You'll start to feel this contraction. You'll feel it in your body. You'll start to feel this taking place. And so with the practices that, again, this is why one of the reasons we did this openness practice. If we practice openness, we have an opportunity, by contrast, to see how closed we are, right? If we don't create the contrast medium of openness, we won't see how contracted we are. So with these practices of openness, we will attain somewhat exquisitely painful sensitivity to how contracted we always are. It's a little bit like, gosh, before we create a contrast medium, it was like, oh my gosh, I never realized I had so many thoughts before, right? Now, it's like, oh my God, I never realized how contracted I was. Slightly painful revelation, but a good one. You can't give a cure until you make a diagnosis. In this case, the diagnosis is tremendous defensive self-contraction. And so the beauty of this practice, and this is extremely practical stuff. I mean, I have saved myself a lot of trouble, probably gotten out of, not gone to bed with people and not gone thrown into jail because of this relationship to contraction. Impulse control is birth control, right? I feel the contraction. I feel it coming. I can just sense it. And then, before I would just capitulate, it was just my normal reactive karmic habitual thing. Default mode network, that's just where I went. But with enough open practices, like, well, there it is, I catch it. And then what I do is I notice the minute I do that, what's happening is it's squirting me up into here. I'm starting to disconnect from my body. I'm starting to have an out-of-body experience, right? So the question, the trick here is you notice it, you're aware of it, recognition and liberation, somewhat simultaneous. And so then what you do is you stay in your body. Stay in your body. Because your body is the crucible of transformation. Your body knows what to do with this. This is where the problems start when you kick it up. And you'll feel that tremendous impulse to come up here, to say, to speak, to rationalize, to blah, blah, blah. You catch that impulse and you stay with the sensation. And this is not easy, because usually the sensation is unwanted. It's painful. You don't want to be there. And so you express from that space. You relate from your mind instead of to it. That's a really powerful jingle. You relate from your mind instead of to it. What we want to do is relate to our minds instead of from them. See? So you feel the contraction, you feel it coming on, and you just stay with your body. And what I do now is actually a type of investigation. I will actually, where am I feeling it? Contraction in my stomach, contraction in my heart, where am I feeling it? I stay with that. And then if I have to say something, I come from that stance, I come from that space, which then comes from a space of openness, kindness, compassion, understanding, instead of reactive, defensive, or offensive strategies. When you've already lost it, it depends on how much momentum is already established. If it's like fully steamrolled and in your massive klesha attack, then, you know, you have to use kind of grosser level skill sets to relate to that. One would be to just literally step away from the situation physically, counting to 10, not a bad idea. Somehow get away from what triggered the thing and allow yourself, again, the fundamental structure will be the same, then allow yourself to return into your body, because what created the explosion was the inability to catch the trigger. But the cure fundamentally is the same. But the second one, you have to get away a little bit more sometimes. But then even then, the trick is, okay, what am I feeling? What am I feeling? What do I not want to feel? What do I not want to feel? Stay, stay, stay. Not easy, but very powerful. Because then if you do that, then you'll discover how powerful your body is in terms of handling these energies. Your body knows what to do with them. The trouble starts up here. Something like that? Okay?
No.
Well, I'm wondering if you would share your thoughts on mirror meditation. I've had some powerful experiences with this simple practice. Well, I'm not quite sure. Who asked this question? Yeah. Tricia, what do you mean by mirror meditation?
Actually staring into a mirror.
Mirror meditation is actually part of the practice of what's called impure loose reform. And it's a very, very interesting practice to do. And I did this actually as part of my training, a three-year retreat, where this may not be entirely true to what you're talking about, but what we did that was really powerful. And when I first was given these instructions, I thought it was so ridiculous. I said, are you kidding me? But the instruction was literally to stand in front of a mirror and, you know, for X period of time, praise the reflection. You know, you're looking at yourself and you know, for you do. I've done this with groups. It's freaking hysterical. I've done it in a room where we have mirrors set up, literally all around the room. It's absolutely bloody hysterical. And I read the instructions from the classic text, so people realize I'm not making this stuff up. And then what people do is they look in these full length mirrors, and the first part of the exercise is to like, and for many people this it's easy. It's interesting, like what's easier, what's hard for people. So the first part of the instruction is to praise the reflection. With real like conviction and passion, you know, you're the best thing since toilet paper. You know, you're God's gift. I mean, you know, you let your imagination run wild. And then you just, first of all, after the, you know, self-conscious contrived, this is a silly thing, it's actually somewhat interesting, believe it or not. So you do that for a little while, and then you do the other thing. You flip yourself off the mirror. You worthless piece of whatever. It's interesting. Some people have an easier time with that. It's easier for them to do that than to say, oh, I love you, you're so amazing. It's easier. They feel more comfortable doing this. And so the idea is to develop what's called mirror mind. Mirror mind, which means it's a practice of equanimity. Can you relate to praise and blame with equanimity? And when I first did this thing, I was like, are you kidding me? This comes from a 1,500-year-old wisdom tradition? I'm not going to do this. But I had like a month. And I kind of like had to do it. So I really got into it. You know, I really got into it. And I'm telling you, what, 20 years I've been out, it remains one of the most powerful practices I did. Because now when people praise me, oh, it's just like praising the mirror. You know, it doesn't affect me that much. When people blame me, that's even more important. It doesn't affect me that much anymore.
That's just not like how you act.
I know, exactly. I'm doing that for pedagogical purposes for you, Andrea. But the idea... The idea, as silly as it is to praise and blame as a way to establish an equanimous relationship to praise and blame. It's actually quite powerful. The whole idea, of course, is to usurp the ego, right? Or you have to express it, and then just see how you relate, react. And then eventually relate to both praise and blame in the same way.
It seems like it would kind of put some distance between the ego and you, whatever that is.
Yeah, it's different for different people. So, second part, if appropriate and time permits, would you please discuss how to interact with those who use the concept of non-existence to spiritually bypass accountability for self. Yeah, I am going to talk a little bit about this more later when we get into emptiness proper, because emptiness has a couple of massive near enemies. One of them is nihilism, and the second one, there's a number of them, a second very common one is called spiritual bypassing. Do people know this term? It's a really important, beautiful term. It came from John Wellwood. People don't credit him for this. He just died recently. Wonderful, wonderful man. PhD psychologist. Best books on relationship I've ever read. Journey of the Heart and Perfect Love and Perfect Relationship. So John Wellwood coined this term spiritual bypassing, which is where you use these concepts of non-duality, the concepts of emptiness, fundamentally as a way to prematurely dismiss relative concerns like developmental issues, psychological issues. You use non-duality to disparage duality, absolute truth to belittle relative truth, unity to kind of deride individuality. And it is epidemic in the spiritual community. Because very often, it's like A.H. Almas, do you know his work? Hamid Ali, Diamond Heart, he's another really brilliant psycho-spiritual thinker, physicist who turned spiritual practitioner, brilliant guy. He basically says when people set out on a spiritual path, they're unwittingly setting out for heaven. People want out. People want out. And spiritual bypassing is epidemic in the spiritual community. And so this is where you need to remember what Trungpa Rinpoche once said. Again, the master of the one-liner. Amazing statement when he said, there is no way out. The magic is to discover that there's a way in. And what he said, which is just beautiful, another line, the absolute experience of duality is the experience of non-duality. Wow. The absolute experience of duality is the experience of non-duality. So getting out, bypassing, is a consequence of our cult of theism. Again, not dismissing it, but you know, to attain salvation, we have to go somewhere else, to heaven. It's also called cosmological dualism. David Loy writes about it. And it's really common in the spiritual business, where fundamentally, you just basically want to FedEx your awareness outside of the domain of materialism and matter. That's fundamentally leads to a very partial, disembodied form of enlightenment, in really a deep trap, where I heard one teacher say, no kidding, a so-called, I can't remember what tradition, maybe best that I don't know, I think Ken Wilber told me this, where he heard somebody, some spiritual master, some Buddhist guy say, you know what, I'm not really that concerned about global warming because I'm going to a Pure Land when I die. I mean, like, really? Seriously? So spiritual bypassing is a big deal. And so when I come and talk a little bit more about emptiness, we'll come back to some of these issues. Because it's very easy when you start talking about emptiness, nothingness, to become either nihilistic or dismissive of relative concerns. That's a very, very distorted perception of these teachings. So we'll come back to that. It's really important because it's ubiquitous. It's omnipresent in the spiritual business. People just want out. There is no way out. Could you please speak briefly to the question, how does dying before you die help you live more fully before you die? Awesome. Well, you know, again, we're not really living fully until we die. We're fundamentally approximating our existence. We're fundamentally AWOL on reality. We're all MIAs, right? Missing in action. Just take a look at your experience to see if this is not the case. And in fact, they've done some very interesting studies. A very classic study now that's been cited thousands of times. Literally, the title of the study is A Wandering Mind is an Unhappy Mind. And what these scientists did, using phones and the whatnot, they would ping people on their phones throughout the day and say, like, what are you doing right now? What are you thinking? And through collecting this data, they discovered that, I can't remember what the exact data was, but the vast majority of time, people were just lost in discursive thought. You know, they're not present for their lives. And so in order to become fully present for your life, you have to die to the default mode networks that pull you away from reality and into your versions of reality. And so specifically, if you die before you die, how does it help you live more fully? It makes you much more present. It makes you fully more alive to what's happening. And so I think that alone helps you live more fully. Because, and this is the great irony, you know, in a certain sense even larger, one of the great gifts of studying this stuff for me, and maybe for those of you who work in hospice, who have been contemplating this, who've already experienced this, one of the great surprise benefits of practicing and studying this material is it's stunning to me how much it has actually empowered my sense of life. And the best analogy that I came up with, not analogy, the best experience I had that really brought this home is when my mother was dying, you know, 8 or 9 years ago. And I had the great good fortune to be with her in the last weekend of her life. And I love my mom she's like the best mom in the history of the world, right? I mean, I love this woman, like, I make aspirations that I would be born to another mother like her. And so when I was with her, it was the most powerful experience for me because I can assure you, I knew this was going to be the last time I was going to be with her. I wasn't thinking about the future. I wasn't reflecting a whole lot on the past. The embrace of Yama, the embrace of death and impermanence, brought me so fully into the present moment. Because I realized I am not going to be with this amazing person much longer. And to me, it was the most profound gift. Because here's this woman who gave me life by bringing me into the world. And her parting gift to me was to bring me back to life one more time. By riveting me to the present moment. And then I used that as a type of transmission. It was like, how would I relate to you if I knew I would never see you again? How would I relate to the world if I realized I am never going to see this again? So when you actually embrace reality with the embrace of impermanence and death, it actually brings things more to life. So another one, this is kind of humorous. I think this comes from Dan Harris, a hysterically funny book, one of the best introductory books on meditation ever written, in my opinion, called 10% Happier. Has anybody read this book? Oh my God, you gotta read it. It's freaking hysterical. You know who Dan Harris is? The ABC commentator. He's really, really wicked funny. And he wrote this book called 10% Happier. If you want to give a very humorous, self-effacing, wonderful introductory level book to meditation, this is it. And so in this book, he says something hysterical that totally applies here. He says, you know, if you have one foot in the present and one foot, I'm sorry, if you have one foot in the future and one foot in the past, which most of us do, right? You're pissing on the present. That's like freaking beautiful. You have one foot in the future and one foot in the past. You're pissing on the present. So stop pissing on the present. Be present, right? And so, you know, this one of the surprise benefits of studying this stuff. Those of you who work with it or work with hospice, you know, working around dying is really empowering. Man, you start to appreciate what you have. Whoa, you start to appreciate the people in your life. It's a great kind of benefit of this kind of stuff.
Sorry. I think it was supposed to be last night. I was talking to my daughter.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Wait for the mic.
Sorry, yeah. Just to the past and the pissing on the present. Last night I was talking to my daughter, who in Western Australia is in tomorrow morning.
Right.
So I said to her, she's only 9 years old. I said, Daddy's in the, you're in the future and Daddy's in the past.
Awesome.
And she said, well, if I'm in the future and you're in the past, then who's in the present?
Beautiful.
Thanks for the wake-up call.
The wisdom of children. Fantastic. Fantastic.
So I said, yeah. I said, we're all in the present.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Where or how might we find Buddhist hospice or care centers? There aren't many. Zen hospice, right? Rhonda, do you know? Can you speak to this a little bit? There's not that many, unfortunately. We tried to get one going a little bit with Darcy. Do you know, Reva?
Well, there was supposed to be one coming up in Erie, but it's going to be a couple more years.
Yeah, who's doing that? Prescott and Karen? Yeah.
She's a Zenny.
A Zenny. Honestly, I hate to be glib on this, but ask Dr. Google.
Yes.
Just Google it. Again, really, just Google Buddhist hospice. I know the Zen hospice in the famous center run by Frank Ostateski, who recently had a stroke, by the way, is probably the oldest running Buddhist hospice. But there are others.
It just closed, I thought. I thought that
really?
Closed.
Did it? Really?
Oh, no.
Couldn't hear. Did it close? I didn't know that.
That closed. I believe so.
That one closed.
Google it.
Yeah, I can't. I don't know. Sorry. But honestly, without being glib, it's amazing what you find if you just Google the damn thing. There's not many. While doing these practices of meditation, is there any suggestion as to where to place consciousness in the body? Head, heart, hara. Depends on which practice you're doing. If you're doing like the more referential shamatha that we were dealing with, you can place your awareness, you know, again, in your body and breath. Doesn't really matter. Whatever kind of roots you or grounds you into the present moment, which again, your body does that, because the wisdom of the body, again, it only functions in the present moment, right? You can't see the past, like I mentioned. You can't hear the future, smell the past, taste the future. Your senses are always already only operative in the present moment. So we use the wisdom of our senses, the first five senses, to curtail what's called the sixth consciousness, the sixth sense. Well, again, when we talk about the eight consciousnesses, we're going to riff on that. So we use the first five consciousnesses and our body to tame the sixth consciousness, which is the thinking mind, to root it in the body. When you're doing the practices of formless meditation, like we did this afternoon, then you don't really place your consciousness in the body unless something in your body directs your consciousness to that place, right? So in other words, there's no focus. It's the unfocused meditation. If something registers in your body, your mind rests on that. If something else arises that takes, you know, that previously would be a distraction, whatever, you let your mind rest on that. You let your mind rest on whatever arises. In inner yoga practices, which we haven't been doing, that's where this stuff comes into play. When you're doing inner yoga practices, then you work with the different energy centers, the so-called chakras. We'll ping on this a little bit when we talk about subtle body stuff. You place it at the heart chakra if you're doing things like sleep yoga. You place it in the throat chakra if you're doing things like dream yoga. You place it in the hara for dantian, for if anyone's below the navel, if you're doing things like inner heat practices, chandali chumo. You place it in the head chakra if you're doing things like illusory form. So we haven't done those, so there is a place for this type of focus. But in terms of what we're doing here, I think my previous response is, you know, appropriate. Okay? 2 minutes. Yes, exactly. One final question before we close. I like closing at 8:30. Get a little extra space. Are you serious? You want to?
What did you say?
Yeah, why? You mentioned this documentary.
I have to get it in my room. I think maybe for tonight, with your kind permission, since I didn't bring it, I'm going to say let's just go check out. If you want to watch a film, again, I want to be a little bit careful of our energies and the time and like, oh my God, can this guy ever shut up? I think for now it's okay to end. If you're really like, whoa, I want to watch these films, I have a couple really cool documentaries. One created by our mutual friend, Karen Van Buren. Very powerful, beautiful film that she documented of a physician in Boulder who elected to do what's called passive euthanasia, which, by the way, is karmically free. This is one way you can kill yourself without karmic implications. There's a difference between active and passive euthanasia, which is also a little bit different from suicide. Passive euthanasia is basically when you just stop eating or drinking. And the wisdom teachers all say that that's okay. There's no karmic implications to that. If I have the wherewithal and the luxury, I mean, again, that's one of the ways I would like to go. You just stop eating or drinking. It's a little bit uncomfortable, you know, for a couple days. But then what happens is the endogenous, the endorphins are released, the wisdom of the body takes over. And as you'll see in this video, this physician, it becomes quite blissful for him. People all around him are struggling a little bit, like his wife and stuff. But it's a very powerful film about this physician who decides, you know what, I'm going to control my death, passive euthanasia. So I had that film. I also have a really interesting video narrated by Leonard Cohen, written by Penek, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's a Canadian broadcast production, two videos. It's okay, it's not great, but it's okay. Death at a funeral is hysterical. Up to you guys.